Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
This week, we are excited to bring you our guest, Chris Arnotti. He's the author of Dignity. He has one of the best Twitter feeds in the game. He's also been a guest on The Realignment before, so you can go back and listen to that one. It's a great companion episode. We wanted to bring Chris on because Chris is kind of, I would say, and I said this in the episode, kind of the whisperer for non-voters. Chris spent, you know, basically 6 years of his life just traveling in working-class communities, going everywhere that he possibly could, and just talking to underrepresented groups, taking photos of them, accounting their insights within his book, and really just chronicling what life is like for so many communities which have no representation kind of whatsoever in our popular culture. And he's somebody who actually predicted Trump's win back in 2016. So we wanted to check in with him right before the election and kind of just see where his head was at.
Yeah, so we're 7 days out from the election. And the reason why this episode really stuck out for me is that there's this great statistic that we talk about all the time. 100 million people are not going to vote in this election. And I think this could be the side of me that's been in D.C. for 5 years, but I just really struggle with that idea because for me, it seems like this election, for good or for ill, from either side, if you're center left, if you're center right, if you're really conservative, if you're a socialist, the election is these pretty two clear choices. So what Chris is doing a really great job of doing, and he says this on the episode, is he's basically serving as the mob lawyer for people who, in spite of all of this, are not going to vote and don't feel like the current system and our choices really serve them. So he does a really great job of doing that, and he's exactly who we'd like to talk to 7 days out from the election. So as you guys know, we do show questions every week. Give us a rating, 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave us a written review with a 5-star rating, we will answer the question as well. You can also email your question to realignmentpod@gmail.com. So this week's question is actually exactly along the theme of today's episode where we talk about populism. And the question is as following. It is from Donut Trump. I wonder what the argument is there. What are your thoughts on Trump's flopping on his populist promises to rebuild infrastructure?
Yeah, and that really pairs perfectly with this episode. And I think it is his greatest failure as president. I mean, look, I don't want to underplay some of the stuff he did. I think the China trade war is legitimately one of the best moves that a president has made in decades. And he single-handedly changed the conversation around that for the next 25 years of American politics, maybe even longer. There is no way in my mind that Biden could simply just remove all of the tariffs unilaterally. He might remove some, and we can argue about that. But unilaterally, that issue is a, you know, basically 80-20, especially in the context of the coronavirus. But by and large, he did not ultimately deliver on his promise for a large infrastructure package. Basically, what I think it all comes down to is deficit spending. He never conquered the deficit spending, the deficit hawkery within the GOP, whether it be the border wall, whether it be infrastructure, whether it be stimulus, whether it be healthcare, all of it ultimately comes down to the role of government and government's ability to spend, which is a fundamentally libertarian critique of Trump that I think ultimately prevailed under his leadership, largely because he was uninterested in the legislative and governing process and much more interested in cultural fights and with impeachment, Russiagate, and things like that.
So Sagar is talking about the sort of philosophical and sort of policy limitations, but I think it's really important, especially if you sort of move out from this 4-year period after the next week, to really think about the politics here, to think about the fact that if Trump had come into office and said, I'm a different type of Republican. I came because this sort of working class, quote unquote, left behind, forgotten America voted for me. If he then turned around and then did a union-friendly infrastructure package, that is a type of deal that would have fundamentally reimagined American politics. And this isn't just sort of our opinion. Chuck Schumer is on the record. Chuck Schumer's on the record as saying, I don't understand why he didn't do that his first week. Because if they come out with a aggressive infrastructure package, Schumer is on record. So the Democratic Senate Majority Leader is saying, we would not have known what to do. Because at the end of the day, he would have been fulfilling a thing that hypothetically the Democratic Party had been sort of discussing for a long time, but he would have been fulfilling it within a populist nationalist set of Republican rhetoric, and Rui could have enabled him to double down on the expansion of the GOP's base, and this goes to the show's topic today, and his bringing out to vote whole new coalitions of people who didn't turn out before. Yes. That could have been a huge opportunity, and letting that go, regardless of the individual policy details of an infrastructure package, because once again, we could debate that. We're not trying to debate that right now. We're just simply trying to point out is that he could have signaled. Instead, what he chose to do was a failed healthcare push and tax reform. And once again, you could support those two policies from a political, from a policy perspective. You can argue that the regulatory changes that came were worth it. You can argue that the sort of amounts that went to people were a good thing, but they were still terrible political choices. So that goes to our deep frustration there.
Exactly. As always, a special shout out and thank you to our sponsor, the Lincoln Network. The Reboot Conference is coming up the week after the election. Go to rebootconference.org. I'm going to be there. Marshall's going to be there. Many other friends of the show. We're going to be hosting and having some great conversations and panels. Make sure you guys go and check that out. And with that, let's dive in, folks. Chris Arnotti, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you for having me back.
Welcome back to The Realignment.
Welcome back.
Welcome back to The Realignment.
Even though Marshall kindly reminded me of that even before we began, I still forgot. Chris, I'm glad that you're here. One of the reasons that we wanted to bring you back is you first joined us to talk about your book, Dignity, which was a profile of, you know, I mean, it's a photographic a journalist's attempt to capture America writ large, non-voters, voters, and so many more. You're often, I think, unfairly caricatured as some sort of Trump whisperer, when the truth is that you're much more of like what I would call a non-voters whisperer. So just let's start out like very simply. This comes out on Tuesday, 1 week to go before the election. Based on everything you observed in 2016 and since, how do you think it's going to go? And why do you think it's going to go that way?
Thank you, first of all. I'm generally pretty cautious about making predictions, especially since I haven't been able to really get out and see people over the course of the last 8 months. But there's little for me to think that the general view out there that Biden's going to win pretty easily is wrong. Mm-hmm. I think, if COVID hadn't happened, we might be having another discussion, but I think right now, I mean, you know, again, what little I get out, I mean, COVID is everywhere. It's everybody's, it's dramatically changed people's lives. Everybody, right. And there's just really no way you can, you know, remove this election from COVID. And I think it's fair to say that, and I'll stretch to say that Trump hasn't performed well when it comes to COVID. And I don't think there's anybody who, I'm not sure anybody in power right now, and I may be wrong, would be able to handle the chaos of COVID. I mean, it's just disrupting people's lives. And I think most people are going to be pissed off by what's happening by COVID, and they're probably going to blame whoever's in power. Mm-hmm. I think even beyond that, I think the other thing is quite honestly, Trump's appeal, you know, what a lot of people refuse to admit he has, really doesn't work so well when you're the incumbent. It just really is a hard fit. You know, the appeal I saw from Trump was basically, I'm going to throw these bums out. I'm different. I'm not part of the system. I'm going to shake things up. People were willing to take a gamble on that because why not? You know, the people I talked to, they don't see any chance anything changing anyways. Why not take a chance on an outsider who just might, you know, break the narrative and change things. But, you know, he's been in power for 4 years now, and that's a little bit harder of a sell. I mean, you can make it. I think you can, if COVID hadn't happened, he could have pointed to the kind of entrenched bureaucracy, right, as kind of what he's up against. He could have pointed to the media's outrage at everything he does as kind of the sign that he is changing DC and he is on their side. But I think COVID just overwhelms everything right now. And I just really feel it's hard to kind of think about this election beyond that. Although, I mean, there's other influences.
It's funny when you gave your answer to the sort of prediction question, because all of us have our own version of post 2016 November trauma, where we say, well, you know, on the one hand, there's the polls. Like, yeah. None of us will just sort of say that, like, Biden's probably going to win. So we all just, I was talking with this with my parents last night. We all just have our own sort of two sentence sort of pre thing. But let's actually go back to 2015, 2016, because you had a really great tweet, which would be worth talking about, where you said Donald Trump was sort of made to run against Jeb Bush and sort of like the GOP establishment of that sort of time. Can you sort of expand on that and sort of articulate why Jeb was sort of the perfect foil for him?
Yeah, I mean, Jeb was everything wrong with D.C. I mean, right down to the exclamation point, which you're supposed to get excited about, you know, vanilla ice cream because it has an exclamation point on it. it's like, and I, you know, look, I happen to like Jeb Bush. I mean, I feel kind of bad he was the wrong guy at the wrong moment. But, you know, I remember seeing him in New Hampshire a few times. It was painful to watch because he represented a consensus that I think a lot of the population, certainly the GOP kind of base, had moved beyond, where they were frustrated by this idea that, you know, it's kind of the classic, what I saw on Wall Street was, I'm economically conservative, financially, you know, socially liberal. And I think people are just sick of that, and he just kind of warmed over elite kind of conventional wisdom where people didn't see much difference between Jeb and Hillary, you know, and it was just this kind of, you know, what I would say, this overeducated elite consensus that has run the country for so many years and has failed to deliver anything. And Trump was not that. And I think Trump works well when he has a foil, and he kind of defines himself by the foil. And Jeb was the perfect foil. He was everything. I mean, and then he got handed the two perfect foils, Jeb and Hillary, two people who represent what so many people don't like about Washington, which is that they feel like they come and ask for your vote once every 4 years and then ignore you. And just, you know, and behind the scenes, they're basically, they're friends, you know?
So let me ask you this though, Chris, why isn't Joe Biden that? I mean, Biden is on policies almost no difference whatsoever from Hillary Clinton.
I think Biden's there for a reason, because I think he's also, I think it's a little bit of the people swing. Again, if we hadn't had COVID, this would be a slight, I think the election would be a little bit more,
yes,
you know, but I also think Trump is, you know, that's the, I don't think the campaign is really running a good campaign, because that's the attack on Biden.
Right.
Like, you know, where is the attack of, dude, you've been here 40 years, man. Like, you know, what about your vote on the Iraq war? What about your vote on the crime bill? All these things are like, and I think Biden is certainly benefiting from the fact that I think everybody wants Trump out who has power, you know, mm-hmm. the elites. You know, he has his business community friends, but I think that the bulk of the kind of what I call the blue check press, you know, the kind of credential press, they want him out. The secrets, you know, the kind of Washington DC bureaucratic establishment wants him out. And so they're not going to push on Biden. They're not going to ask Biden uncomfortable questions. They're not going to write uncomfortable pieces about Biden. They're just going to lay off Biden because they want Trump out, for, you know, reasons that are both personal and, you know, and moral and, mm-hmm. and what have you. And so I think Biden has gotten a pretty smooth ride here. Sanders didn't lay a hand on Biden because that's just not who Sanders is. You know, Biden, you know, he kind of snuck through because, you know, people didn't think he was, you know, they couldn't believe that this guy who's been around for 40 years and, you know, kind of was, it's kind of like that. I try to say this to somebody, I forget about, there used to be a Soul Survivor marble game when I was a kid, where there was like, I'm the sole survivor. You pull these things out and marbles drop, the idea is to have your marble be the light, and the kid throws up his hand and goes, I'm the sole survivor. Like, yeah. Biden is kind of like the sole survivor. Like, I don't think anybody would have predicted 20 years ago that this dude, you know, and I think people just kind of underestimated him because, you know, we don't have to worry about him. And then once it got to the point where it's him versus Trump, I think people didn't want to worry about him. They just want to go back to something that's not Trump. And yeah. So I think he's been, but I think the Trump campaign has, you know, been pretty badly run this time, in the sense that that's the attack on him. Like, really, dude? Like, you're here for 40 years. Like, you know, you're railing, like, what? And I think that's gotten kind of lost in the campaign. Mm-hmm. But I also think Joe, you know, one of the things I also said about Biden was the best advantage he has is he's not on Twitter. You know, for whatever reason, like, you know, maybe like, you know, geriatrics, but it's just, he kind of goes to the, he's been doing retail, but there is an advantage to being doing politics for 40 years. You know how to do politics.
Yes.
Like, the dude knows how to, like, you know, I was just making fun of Sanders to somebody today about, like, you know, Sanders came out of 2016 with one glaring weakness: working class blacks. The people, the community that I write about in my book. And he did nothing to address it. What did he hired Sean King?
Yeah. What's funny is he hired the opposite. Well, I don't want to sort of impugn people's sort of class status. Yeah, I don't want to guess at it, but he sort of hired hyper online.
Yes,
black
exactly.
People.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, I mean, look, Cornel West is a great dude. I like Cornel West, but no, what you needed to do is what Biden's been doing for 40 years, which is retail politics in black communities. He should have, like, it doesn't take a genius to figure out which counties in South Carolina, it's the Black Belt. He should have lived in the Black Belt for the last 3 years and actually built the relationships. There was almost a slightly offensive attitude that all I have to do is get these high profile African Americans and that's going to win me the vote, as opposed to actually just camping, literally becoming part of the community in a real way. And that's what Biden's done for 40 years. You know, people laugh about the corn pop story, but you know, it's real.
I love corn pop story.
Hey, look, I was one of the few people. I think I said last time I was one of the few people who said, actually, that's a real story. I'm sure it's been exaggerated, what have you. But you know, I've met.
Could you remind people of the?
I will
pop
admit,
story real quick?
I thought the corn pop story was fake. I absolutely thought it was fake.
Did you think coyotes were fake though?
right.
So Chris, could you remind the audience that isn't as online as we are, what the corn pop story was referring to?
I think it was, he said when he was I think the story goes that when he was a lifeguard in the African American community of Delaware. That he had to deal with basically, did he use the word thug?
No, he didn't. I don't know. No. He didn't say something racialized. He didn't say thug. I'm pretty sure he didn't say thug.
I think he called him a bad dude. That's
a bad dude. Which is, again, well done by his part, because he didn't go there. But he basically said there was this dude in the neighborhood who was causing problems and his name was Corn Pop. And he set Corn Pop straight. And everybody fucking just, like, you know, everybody went ballistic. And I'm like, I think I did a tweet, I think I can find it, of all the names of bad dudes in the neighborhoods I've dealt with that were equally absurd. I mean, paycheck, you know, escrow, you know.
And to be fair, somebody did go find an obituary of a dude named Corn Pop. So he might have been real.
The favorite one was the favorite dealer I had to deal with was his name was Mosquito. And I'm like, dude, man, like, you got to change your name. It's like, it's not scaring me.
That's an important point. I want to remind the audience who's not familiar with you. So tell us about your journey in 2016, you know, kind of why and how, like, we all became to be connected from your book, the journey that you took. Tell me about the core insights that you learned on that journey. And then what we are missing this campaign around of themes that spoke to those people or that didn't speak to them. Go ahead.
So I spent basically, you know, quite bluntly, I spent 6 years of my life immersed in basically what people online would call loser communities. It's unfair to call them that, but that's what people would call them. Poor working class, white, black, Hispanic neighborhoods where there's, where people generally don't go. The bulk of that was 3 years in a neighborhood in the Bronx that's famous for drug use and infamous for drug use. The poorest neighborhood in New York, Hunts Point, is unfairly stigmatized, but it does have a lot of drugs. I spent time with heroin addicts. I was under the bridges with them. I, you know, was in cars with them. I helped them shoot up. I did all that. So it was a pretty immersive experience where I was hanging out with some bad dudes who became friends of mine. And then I took the show on the road, as it were, and I did that outside of the Bronx. And I went across the United States, and I did that in places like Portsmouth, El Paso, East LA, Cleveland, Milwaukee. And the theme I basically, I mean, the overall theme is, to be blunt, was people online don't get it. I mean, there's this bulk of people out there. You can call them normies. You can call them flyovers. You can call them non-voters who just are completely missed by Twitter. And missed by the kind of elite narrative out there, you know, the blue checks, if you will. Most, not all. There are some who get it. And so it was just really a surreal experience where I was kind of seeing this immense support for Trump. Even though I wasn't doing what I intentionally wasn't, initially it wasn't political. I was just doing this based on poverty and addiction.
Yeah.
But then it was taking place against the 2015-2016 election. And I saw this groundswell of support for Trump that just was, that basically the people I was talking to of all races were taking Trump seriously when the press wasn't taking him seriously. And seriously, in the Black community, seriously was, this guy's a threat. I mean, this guy's real. He's got some legs, like, you know, what, you guys are treating him like a clown. He's not a clown. We've seen this guy before. And in the white community, it was very resonating. This guy's got a real shot, and I want to. And so there was this disconnect between me and kind of what I saw developing in kind of the elite media of, I think this guy is going to win the GOP nominee, and then I think he has a real shot to win the presidency, because he spoke to something that, you know, that this great disenfranchisement that I saw across the people I was talking, who basically look at what politics is, as we talked about Jeb and Hillary, and just like, no, I don't want to be a part of that. Like, it's just, right. It's done nothing for me. The way you guys talk about it does nothing for me. And when you do come here and talk to me, you do it in this kind of really kind of clownish way where, you know, you think you understand what I am, but you don't understand what I am. Like, the distance between me and you is so great that it's really embarrassing. And so, you know, I mean, there you saw a teeny bit of that. I don't want to overemphasize it because it gets in the recent debate over the issue of Coyote, right? Like, I mean, you know, this idea that people didn't know that coyotes are.
Let's explain this for the audience who aren't on as online. So basically what happened is that Trump talked about used the term coyote, which are people who work for drug cartels and human trafficking organizations who bring, you know, Central American migrants across Mexico to the U.S. southern border. That's just what the term means. You can cast whatever moral aspersions or whatever that you want on there, but that's what the term is. And what happened is that after Trump said that, there was like this large freak out primarily on Twitter of, you know, blue like liberals being like, Trump just referred to migrants as coyotes because they simply just didn't know what the term meant.
Or there were people who basically said, like, there's no way a coyote, a physical animal, can carry someone across the border. Right.
I have the most sympathy for those people. I'm like, that's they're not wrong, right? So I think we need to be precise about that.
But it was one of those things where it's like, one of the things is there's just a difference in language and lived experience. Like, you know, you think you help immigrants, but yet you don't even know the way they talk. You don't know the terms they use. And so, like, if you spend any time in Latino neighborhoods, you know what coyote is. I mean, people talk about it, you know. And so a lot of the time I spent, like, in Hispanic neighborhoods, you know, in El Paso near the border. And so, but that whole sense of the elites having this sense that you know, they don't understand the people they're intending to help is very clear to people who are, you know, they intend to help. And so there's this, it comes across, even if it's well-intentioned, and look, this is where I differ from a lot of conservatives. I think that the liberals are actually well-intentioned. I think they really are well, they just don't understand the community they're attempting to help. And so I think there's this disconnect that comes across as condescending and scolding when in fact they think they're being helpful, but they just don't. And, you know, like, it's the whole just move attitude, you know, just move, which doesn't, it just is so offensive. They don't see it. But that kind of big kind of like echo, this bubble of elites where they just don't get the people they claim to advocate for really comes across at times. And I think it really came across with Hillary Clinton, and it came across with Jeb, two people who, again, have spent all their life in think tanks and DC and Davos and this community that is filled with great ideas and filled with great intentions. This is where I disagree from Lobby. I actually do think they really believe they're helping. It's just that there's just such a huge disconnect between the people they want to help and the people they kind of they claim to advocate for and the people they make policy for, that they often come across as clownish and clueless.
Yeah. So let's talk about this, because how much of the debate about whether people are being helped is about aesthetics, and how much is it about like actual outcomes? Because what frustrates me in the discussion about disenfranchisement and sort of whether or not people should be cynical about the system is that it's sort of a lot of people, and you're not one of them, I think, obscure differences about parties and politicians, because that leads to a situation where they are capable of serving an audience that is cynical about both sides. So Ralph Nader, I don't think, was intending to do this, but I think it was just empirically untrue that there was no difference between Al Gore and George W. Bush. There are people right now with very large audiences who are claiming there's no difference between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, so they're just not going to vote. And that's ridiculous to me. That's just like not true on every single level. And I think at a certain degree, if you're a high information person, you're making that claim, in bad faith. And your politics is much more about the aesthetics of the way politicians act, aka both parties definitely are DC, New York centric, but that doesn't mean the policies they pursue are the same. So what do you think about that dynamic?
Well, I think there's two things. One is that we can go back to the conversation about why it's probably, why Trump will probably lose, is he did fail to deliver. Like, I go to all those things. Like the tweet you started off with, where I said that basically, he defined himself as being against Jeb. Jeb won. Like he governed like Jeb, with a different, the exclamation point was different. It was crude online Twitter stuff, but he was still kind of a DC. So I think your point is correct in the sense that the aesthetics was, Trump had the aesthetics of, and that's what still appeals, is that he actually does still posture saying I'm different, and he is different, in the way he behaves, and he's willing to kind of knock down some kind of sacred cows that everybody knows are absurd, the absurdity around the debates, he's just willing to punch a hole in them. And I think people appreciate that, but he hasn't delivered. And, I think if he had actually kind of, and this is the part I don't understand because I'm not very close to DC, is like, why did he end up basically becoming a Jeb or Marco Rubio or kind of Scott Walker, which is he kind of became the, fiscally conservative, socially, the social liberal parts is arguable. He probably gave him more on the socially conservative side, but he didn't deliver. And I think that hurts him too. I mean, he can't really, when I'm watching the debates with him and Biden, it's embarrassing on both sides, but I feel when I watch Trump kind of trying to explain his accomplishments, he's really a fish out of water, man. Like, this is not where he's strong, because he doesn't have anything he can say. This, he moved in the right direction as far as his voters are concerned on trade, but yet at the same time he didn't go far enough. I think his inclinations are kind of, I still think his inclinations are inclined to be the anti-Jeb, which is to be a fiscally liberal, socially conservative, which I think is the great quadrant that is unserved currently. And I think a lot of people I talk to are there, but I think somehow he didn't go there. He just didn't go there in a full force for whatever reason. But I think there is a difference in the parties, and I think how that difference plays out, does impact elections, and does, in one of the things I wrote about in the piece about non-voters is they actually have opinions, even though they don't vote, they have opinions. They just don't think it's worth the time to vote because, it's not their sport, right? So they actually have a person they would vote for if they voted, but it's just like, why bother taking the time when it doesn't, it's not going to matter anyways.
Well, quick thing. But I guess this is what I don't understand, right? And I think I'm really not trying to sound sort of like I'm from DC and I don't really get it. But there are always, from my perspective, I think the perspective of a lot of people on the audience's side, there's always very straightforward ways that we could say voting matters, right? So for example, Medicaid expansion is a pretty clear situation where that was a policy outcome that from a variety of empirical levels from a policy perspective, but also from my like, would you want this policy to happen? That would make their lives empirically better from their perspective. What I also add too is like right to work laws. Another example of like, you know, if we're talking about a GOP that's sort of friendlier to unions, well, that's something that frankly is something that comes from sort of the older GOP that in many ways this podcast is very frustrated with. So like, I don't really, how do we sort of balance the whole idea of recognizing there's this whole segment of voters who don't like the status quo, but also at the same time, I think we could recognize that they are not making a valid assessment of what the sort of policy, like let's say the policy sort of buffet looks like. That's what I just don't understand.
I think one of the things is like there, I think people, this is the great question is, you know, I think people actually vote on symbolic issues because that's easier to grasp and that feels like it has, you know, so it feels like something that's a little bit more tangible, so believe it or not. And so I think symbolic issues become this kind of this battleground to define yourself because, you know, the other issues are a lot more complex and a little harder to kind of drill down on. I think that, but there, you know, there are policies that really like, you know, again, you know, I don't understand politics and I don't understand DC, so I won't understand this is why Trump didn't just give people money during COVID. Like,
oh, I can explain that to you, Chris. It's a great story.
But, yeah. but I mean, that's him. Trump dollars. Mm-hmm. Like that's
Trump bucks. It was literally a thing. Yeah.
With his signature. It's easy.
Yeah.
But you want to talk about policy that impacts people. That's a policy like, you know, man, like I have a daughter who's extraordinarily uninterested in politics, completely uninterested in politics, but man, she got her Trump check, you know? And like, you know, that registered with her, like, you know, she cleared that money and she, you know, she went and bought a new headset for her gaming. You know, she's a gamer. Like, you know, that was a big thing. That was like, you know, and that's what I mean by like, why? It's just like,
I see the problem you have is that you're a rational person who's thinking about electoral outcomes. And the GOP is much more of, I'll borrow this from Julius Krein, is much more of a philosophy cult, which likes to talk about Alexis de Tocqueville and the national debt than they do about electoral outcomes. And so what they would say is that, well, we're just ideologically opposed to, you know, more stimulus checks in the middle of a pandemic. So that they are the ones who ultimately Trump listened to because he's actually just not all that interested in legislative politics.
That's a huge failure. That's an absolute huge failure.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Because that doesn't fit at all the Trump I saw in 2016, mm-hmm. who actually took great joy in kind of, you know, puncturing DC bloated egos and got a lot of traction out of that from his voters. You know?
I remember him, one second, Chris, I remember him saying on the trail, it's not the Republican Party, or sorry, it's not the Conservative Party. It's the Republican Party. And he got cheers for that.
And his early days in DC were defined by fighting with Mitch McConnell, right?
Right.
Like, and like that actually was a winning strategy, I thought. I mean, like, for whatever reason, again, I think there's a lot of, he failed to do out of he's not been a very good populist as far as populists go. I mean, if you look, you know, if you look at what's happening in Brazil, Bolsonaro, right? He gave out money, not necessarily willingly, but he did, and now he's popular. Like,
even though he screwed up coronavirus dramatically, I want to be very clear about that.
So it's just kind of like it's mystifying to me, like why. You know, going back to your thing is I would actually see that's not the way I saw DC Republicans because I always saw, I don't know if you're a gamer, if people listening to this are gamers, but
I'm sure we have some gamers.
Yeah. Gamer adjacent is this podcast.
Yeah. the term is called objective player. In gaming, there's the objective player, which is, you know, you take your object, you take your territory, and it's not nearly as sexy as just killing people, for instance, or getting lots of kills. The much smarter players understand the rules, and it's called an objective player. You go for your objects, right? You know, you take your three flags and you sit on them even without killing a lot of people. And I always thought that GOP was objective players. They understood, you know, I look at the Supreme, how they played the Supreme Court, how they played, but they've always understood that the, you know, don't go for the flashy wins, go for the things that gain power. So that's why I don't understand, because the objective win was to basically give out money. You know, it's just like, it was the right thing electorally. It was the right thing morally. It was the right thing economically. It was the right thing on so many levels. And this is what I, you know, when I see people push back and say, you know, Trump's a fascist, Trump's a, you know, authoritarian. I mean, he's a pretty bad one then, if he didn't like, you know, he didn't use COVID to do all the authoritarian-y things that would have worked. You know, that actually were probably called for.
Or were broadly popular.
Yeah, right. Called for and, you know, justifiable. Like, you know, there was a lot of authoritarian-y things to do then that would have helped. So that's why I get kind of confused.
Chris, I got to say, this is a tangent, but whenever you talk about not understanding DC, I really see this parody version of your second book, which is just you driving around DC steakhouses and J. Crews, and you take pictures of us in our suits, and you see our podcast rig. You're trying to understand how we're thinking about the world.
I'll take you around, Chris. Yeah.
I mean, I understand New York, and so finance, I guess, is not too different from DC.
Yeah, that's actually a good way to put it, which is that if you just sort of look at tech and you look at DC and LA, sort of like the big centers, like obviously the aesthetics are different, but the function, but the structure and the underlying idea and the sort of nature of networks are similar. But no, but on this topic, I think the thing that just can't be undercounted enough is that something that happened over the past 4 years was everyone created this sort of intellectual version of Donald Trump that just didn't act. And this isn't a hot take, but it's true, which is that there was this thought that there was this sort of idea of Trumpism, but I think what we sort of saw happen is in 2015, 2016, Trump had very good instincts, especially when he's in a fight. So when he's fighting Jeb Bush, he understands he should fight him on the Iraq War. He should fight him on privatizing Social Security. He gets that. But when it actually came into governing, those instincts didn't serve him quite as well. And because of the culture war and because of the impeachment fights, he very quickly was able to sort of change his enemy from sort of the establishment to sort of the Democratic Party, in a way that was incredibly unproductive for him, and in a way that also just sort of explained his things. And also the thing to sort of, you know, emphasize here is that there are very few Republicans who actually favor preserving Social Security the way he sort of did it. Like when Trump and Bannon sort of went out of hand and literally said they wanted to raise taxes on wealthy people, there's like five serious people in the GOP who could staff a White House, who could work on think tanks, who actually believe that. So I think there's just this huge gap between the actual sort of like chessboard and what Trump was saying.
But I think also I think a lot of basically Michael Lind's book, I don't know if you've talked to him.
New Class War, yeah.
He's been on the podcast, yeah.
I mean, you know, part of the failure of populism is, you know, you don't have people to staff the bureaucracy, right?
Right.
I mean, literally, like you don't. So, you know, you have these ideas that are considered so profane within the, you know, within the kind of it's not the deep state, because but it's the vast bureaucracy of just people who live in Northern Virginia and, you know, and go and read lots of, you know, Thomas Friedman and, you know, are on the 20-year, 30-year plan I don't know my G's, like G13, G14,
GS, yep. Yeah, GS,
the federal pay scale.
Yeah, like, you know, and are committed to basically being part of the bureaucracy, and, you know, and they're generally decent people, and, you know, and they have their views, and they don't want to see someone to come in and disrupt them, and they don't want to necessarily. And I think he just didn't have, you know, there are two basically views that Trump has that I feel are extraordinarily counter to DC. One of them is basically on foreign policy. I think his instincts are kind of nationalistic, almost, staying out of foreign invention. And I don't think anybody in DC wants to work with that. He can't find people who want to basically, you know, because the DC establishment is so wed to kind of an imperialism, that I think, you know, it's hard to find people who are willing to sign up with that. And I think the other one he has, and so I tend to agree with him. And I think that's less his view. I think that's kind of the view of a lot of people who voted for him. And I think he himself is kind of mixed on that. He gets a little too excited about, you know, doing deals with people like North Korea, but just for personal reasons. But I think his instincts are kind of anti-imperialism. And I think DC just hates that. That's like the antithesis of DC. And the other one he has is anti-immigration. And I think that's very much his. And I think that's extraordinarily popular with his voting base. And it's one I don't share. So let me just say that before people yell at me online. I happen to be Catholic. And so I have a very different view of immigration than most people I interviewed have. But I can tell you as a reporter or as an ethnographer that closing the borders in a meaningful way is extraordinarily popular. Closing the borders in a way that, and again, it's not, there's a view that I think there's a term, I think is liquid modernism. I think people are okay with immigrants coming to the community. It just has to be slow, man. it has to be a kind of, you know, one of the most stunning moments I had on my 8-year journey was I spent a lot of time in El Paso. And for those of you who know El Paso, there's actually a border wall in El Paso. There's a fence. I mean, it goes between it and Juarez, which is the 3 million people Mexican city. Literally, that's basically part of El Paso. It's just a border. There's a fence and I think 4 pedestrian crossings. Anyway, so I interviewed people along the fence. The fence was constructed, I think, by Bush. But the fence actually cuts through people's backyards, you know, because they constructed it. So I interviewed people along the fence who, not surprisingly, almost everyone is Mexican American. Almost everyone is a recent immigrant. Their parents are. And almost all of them like the fence, you know, and almost all of them were kind of, I had some jaw-dropping conversations with people who were like, yeah, I think it's good that we shouldn't let any more people in. I'm like, well, wait, you recently came in, you know, oh yeah, that's okay. But we shouldn't let any more in. So I think there's this disconnect between DC and the policy elite and the population on immigration. And so I think it's such a for instance, like I wouldn't work for a Trump party based on the immigration things. Like, so there's just a lot of people who he needs to staff the bureaucracy, to staff, you know, the engine, to who have the credentials to run the machine, who are like, no, I'm not going to do that.
Let me ask you this though, Chris, you recently, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, anybody who's listens to me, the podcast Rising, et cetera, has heard me basically push things in this direction. And it's funny, even before I get to my question, I was just looking at this New York Times data on who gives to Trump versus who gives to Biden. And it's just incredible. I mean, 77% of Trump's money from his campaign comes from zip codes where the median household income is below $100,000. And over almost half, I think, of Joe Biden's money comes from above 100K. And that the majority of that money, it far outpaces some of the smaller dollar donations. We're talking about New York City, the Upper West Side, giving $8 million from a single zip code just within the Upper West Side.
I can almost guess the zip code.
Right. I'm sure you could. And it's astounding to me, like the base or where the, you know, Trumpism at its best kind of connects even after everything, after just 4 years. I'm not saying it's a winning coalition, but these are the people that it is talking to. But you expressed in a recent interview, I think it was with American Compass, just general pessimism about any sort of working class GOP. Frankly, I think it is the only way that they could ever win an election ever again. Tell us why you're pessimistic. Why do you think it's not likely to become a thing?
GOP popularism, yeah. Basically.
Yeah, basically a Trumpist GOP at its best.
I mean, it's the Jeb wing, like it's the fiscal.
Call them the exclamation wing, please make that a thing.
The exclamation wing. It's the deficits matters people. It's the we have to worry about Social Security. It's the false they need economic populism, and that means basically they need to an economic nationalism, which is to America first, U.S. markets first, trade. Right. They need to put you know, and when I, when I talk about immigration, it's also anti-free trade. You know, it's just like people don't want to see their factories gone. So there needs to be a retooling of an economic populism. There's a big market for economic populism that both emphasizes nationalism, but also emphasizes basically expanding fiscal policy, spending more on working class, being more expansive, being more generous, you know. And I just, as you said, there's a ideological part of the Republican Party that's just extraordinarily wed against that. That's just, and I don't know, you know, if you had asked me 3 years ago, I thought, being naive about DC, I would have thought the GOP might have been able, that would be an easier switch to just simply say, okay, we will spend more. We'll put U.S. companies first. You would think that would be an easier switch because it's popular, but yet, so I think that's why I used to say that the Republicans had a better chance of becoming the working class party, because I think that's an easier switch than socially getting people to switch on social issues. I'm not going to switch my social issues because that's just morally, I don't, but I, you know, I think it's easier to switch your economic views than social views. So, but yet I don't see the GOP doing that. I mean, it's just, and you know, it's just that. Again, I don't want to sound, I don't want to be conspiratorial or wacky sounding, but you know, the people I know who are the elites I know, and I know quite a bit of them because of my career in banking. I mean, they're globalist first. Yeah. I mean, they you know, they care about markets first and foremost. They care about expanding their markets, and anybody who's going to put an impediment to their market is going to, you know, no, I'm not. I don't want that. I need to be able to sell. You know, in people are, you know, dancing around the issue of China. Like, if you're a businessman, right, it's very hard. And again, the mentality of businessmen is they look at a spreadsheet, they look at a billion consumers, and they're like,
yeah, done deal.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't really care. I can justify, you know, you can come at me all the day with the moral reasons not to do this, but right. You know, 1 billion times 1% times, you know, $3. Wow. You know, so they care about selling things to the, and, you know, the Republican Party is still a party of that. You know, and both to going back to kind of pushing back to saying that, the parties, I'll fight against the narrative that the parties are different. I think the parties are both at the elite level wed to opening the markets to everybody. And I think the Republicans are probably more wed than Democrats at this point. Although, you know, the move of the Democratic Party in the last 5-10 years of towards basically Google, Facebook, you know, companies who need a big global market, you know, the powers that be, the elites want their politicians to open as many markets to them as possible. And keep their labor cheap in the U.S. That's what they want.
Right.
So here's the question. If we're sort of talking about these voters who, for good and bad reasons, I think feel disenfranchised, like, what is the answer to the problem? Because if you sort of read Michael Lind, to your point of your reference, I suggest people go back to our episode of him at the start of season two. He basically says populism doesn't work. It's really good at surfacing the issues we're talking about, but it's not where the solution sort of comes from. So one response could be we need more populist and outsiders, but another response could be that we need a more chastened establishment of sort of both parties. I don't know if you guys saw it, but I went back and watched the West Wing special that HBO Max put out. And it was, and here's the thing, I was laughing going, it was actually very good. It was actually very, very well done. It was a really good episode. Like, seriously, people go watch it if you're an HBO Max subscriber. I think we're reviewing something about our podcast demographic here. But at the end of the day, though, like, during the episode, Josh Lyman, like a major White House figure, literally talks about, quote, free trade is literally the thing that helps us be good as a country. It's this empirical fact. There was no sort of debate. And this was just a throwaway line in the show. Obviously, that's not, clearly not, no one would make that statement today.
Right.
Even at its worst, it would be much more like, well, we could debate what happened in sort of the Rust Belt, but there's more nuance now. So the question for me then is populism the answer, or is a more chastened sort of establishment the answer?
You know, I mean, like the establishment, if they're smart, and they are smart, well, basically, you know, you can only vote, you can only get people to, you know, to vote against their own economic, their own interest, or their, you can only frustrate people so long before they rebel. Right. You know, and so I think, you know, it's like, again, what do they deliver? Do they deliver, you know, if you keep on having these towns kind of, you know, people just have the only way to have opportunity is to leave your town for, you know, 75% of people's towns, not necessarily 75% of people in the country, because some of these towns are small. But if the only path to success is to leave X, and, you know, eventually I think, you know, people are going to rebel against that some way. I think the path forward is going to be a lot. You're going to have a lot of one term presidencies, and it's going to ping pong. I think it was in 2013 or 2014, I wrote my first piece, and I called it "Why the U.S. Has Become an Emerging Market Country." I spent my career as a banker was spent in basically poor countries, Brazil, Argentina, Turkey, Russia, parts of Africa, South Africa, basically. And my background as a child was my dad was basically, he specialized in basically Venezuela and Brazil and Bolivia and Peru. And those are places I know pretty well growing up. And, you know, what you have in these places is you have the politics just shift between the elites win, they piss off the masses. The masses revolt, and in comes a populist who fucks things up, and then the elites win again. It's just ping pong between these two, and the thing is that those two groups become more and more disenfranchised from each other. They start living in their own little bubbles. The elites basically move away to basically secluded communities with high gates. And the people then basically rally around charismatic figures who promise the moon. And it just, so when the charismatic figures who promise the moon get in power, they end up getting corrupt and they drive the economy in the ground. And then the elites win again. And then I see that playing out. I see a kind of a ping pong between the two.
Interesting.
Where I think we're going to get, you know, we're going to get elitism 2.0 with Biden, where he's going to come in and he's going to
Freudian slip.
Exactly.
Let Fauci lead, Chris. Let Fauci lead.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's going to be all those things, you know, where they'll overplay their hand, and the next populists, who, and there's going to be a lot of them, who are going to look at Trump. And I think that's pretty well established. People realize, like, they're kind of the larval Trumps who are going to take the lessons from him and kind of expand on it. But I think that, you know, the smart thing to do for the elites is to kind of eat some humble pie, and recognize that there are two or three big issues from which they are disconnected from the population: on immigration, on free trade, basically imperialism, which is kind of, you know, the imperialism basically messing around in other countries, and that sort of role I think is broadly unpopular, and I think there's going to be people who are going to come. If they try to solve that, you know, we'll see, and then they can basically reform immigration in a real way that actually, you know, but it's probably, they're not going to do that because, both morally, there's a very strong moral case for immigration, which I happen to be on, which is stronger than the economic case. But they'll make the economic case, you know, cheap labor. The war is, the overseas war is, I just, you know, the imperialistic streak is just, I don't understand why they do it, but they do it. And then, you know, free trade, they're going to just, again, you know, their spreadsheets, they need to grow, they need profit growth, right? And when you look at any multinational, the profits are coming from overseas more and more, right? You know, so they're gonna continue to do that. So I don't really see them changing the broad path they've gone in. Now,
very interesting. Yeah.
What's interesting is, I think, is we'll see if Biden actually becomes more, you know, if the Democrats can actually, if he can lose the deficit scold within his party and just basically become someone who actually basically expands economically the role of government by actually pumping money into the economy. That's something where I think he could have a real appeal, and he could surprise in that direction, because I think the MMT crowd has provided him a springboard to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Marshall, Chris, I'd love your guys' thoughts on this. I was having this debate with somebody today where somebody on Wall Street was saying, well, you know, if Biden wins in a landslide, then actually Wall Street needs to worry. Well, you know, watch out, you know, 53, 54 Democratic senators, they could pass like all this stuff. And I was thinking about it and I was like, you know, if there's a landslide victory for Joe Biden, 1984 style, right? That means all the upper middle class suburbanites abandoned the GOP and went Biden. And that the marginal type senators who had won would be in a place like Georgia, Kansas, you know, North Carolina, somewhere. I mean, those people are going to basically just be like Joe Manchin, right? So like the extra Democrats in the Senate are not going to be, you know, like an Elizabeth Warren. They're going to be like a Joe Manchin. Think about Scott Brown, who represented Massachusetts back in 2010, who basically had to functionally, you know, act like a center left Democrat. That's kind of how I see what's going to happen. And that deficit scoldery is definitely that runs deep within that kind of upper middle class suburbanite coalition who have always been kind of natural fiscal conservatives. I'd just love to hear what you guys think about that.
Yeah, I mean, and the key thing, we're not talking about sort of the other actor in this, which is the GOP. And this is, right. We've talked about this on the show, which is that the second, if Joe Biden wins, the second that happens, the GOP is going to pivot to deficit hawkery. The GOP is going to say the lesson of the last 4 years isn't staffed properly. It isn't sort of come up with a version of Trumpism that makes sense. It's not your point, Chris, about sort of changing the orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. It's going to be Trump spent too much. Ben Sasse was talking about the whole drunken sailor critique, which which is what's frustrating about this and what I think reflects a high degree of bad faith in this argument is that we could debate whether or not like deficit spending, MMT, whether those things are good or bad, but any political analysis of the last 4 years will not tell you that the reason why Trump did badly in the midterms and why he would lose next right. week would be because of money, spending money. That's just not true. And anyone who claims that is acting in fundamental bad faith on that sort of topic. What do you think, Chris? Yes.
I've learned to realize that some people can be remarkably ignorant about things they are not supposed to be remarkably ignorant about. Yes. I'm of the view that Trump, you know, look, if Trump wins and all this episode is going to be embarrassing.
That's all right. It's got a week to get its ratings before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you know, I mean, I'm of the view that Trump is probably going to lose because he hasn't spent enough. I mean, that to me is just pretty obvious. And so it's hard for me to fathom that anybody thinks the other side. I mean, if they're doing it, I have more respect for them if they're doing it out in sheer cynicism and they actually know that's wrong and they're just lying to get their point for whatever reason. Then I have more respect for them. At least they get it and are choosing to, for real political reasons, to not get it. But I think to me, it's pretty back to the original question. The deficit scolds are deep in both parties. My years on Wall Street were defined by Clinton running a surplus, you know, and being right. very proud of it as kind of his landmark achievement. I was on the desk that traded U.S. government bonds, and people were trying to figure out what they were going to do differently because the U.S. government bonds were going away. The deficit scolding goes deeper in some ways in the Democratic Party because they view it as kind of an academic, like, you know, certainty, like, mm-hmm. don't you know the math? Duh. So it's kind of like, so I don't see, you know, I'm not sure which senators would be peeled away and whether that would be more likely to spend. But the biggest kind of confusion goes again is, look, I'm not an MMT person. I think it's a lot of, ideology.
Let me just explain MMT for people who don't know what it. Chris is referring to something called modern monetary theory. Stephanie Kelton, who's actually going to be on the podcast soon, she kind of popularized this idea in a book called The Deficit Myth.
And it's a very good book, by the way. People should read it.
Fantastic book. I've read it. And we had her on Rising as well. And basically, her thesis is that deficit spending does not matter and that budget surpluses actually are a bad thing because, and Well, I'll let her explain it, but that's the very basics of the argument.
Thanks for being humble.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even going to.
The point that they are entirely right about
yeah.
is that currently, right now, the U.S. has a lot of room to spend. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't buy the argument that, you know, I think it's very limited to the U.S. and it's limited to right now. Right now means this 10-year period, this 5-year period. The U.S. has a lot of the U.S. has a lot more room to spend, and I don't care how you argue it, they do, and so they should spend. And we've limited ourselves to we've used budget deficits as a way to basically limit spending in a way that's been extraordinarily harmful to the poor and extraordinarily beneficial to the rich. And so it's a very elitist, and it's insulting that we've done that. And it's frustrating to me that neither party has recognized, because it should be an easy thing to want to do, man. Like, usually you have to worry about politicians in emerging market countries spending all the time, because right. it's so damn popular for such obvious reasons. So it's kind of mystifying to me why nobody here wants to do it. Because, and whoever does that, I think, is going to be a very popular party for a long time. Now, where I disagree with Stephanie, I don't know if I disagree with Stephanie, because I probably have to talk to her about it, but where I disagree with a lot of the story over MMT is that this is not always the case. We have it now, and at some point it's going to turn. Mm-hmm. But currently we have the ability to spend, and we should. And, you know, and to the benefit of basically the people I write about, you know, we should reform healthcare and basically spend a lot more money so that people can, we should make people, that's a rubber hits the road. You talk about difference in issues, people right. just, healthcare, you know, you can go into the most disenfranchised group of non-voters. And the one thing they care about is healthcare, because, like, you know what, it's a rubber hit the road issue. It's like you can ignore, you know, gay marriage if you're not gay. You can ignore all these things. You can ignore, you know, 401k caps and empowerment zones and all that crap, but you can't ignore healthcare, man. It's just like, you got to go to the doctor. And we could spend more money on healthcare. We can spend more money basically giving people simple services that just basically cut them checks, man.
And this is the key thing. Sagar, I'm bringing this up because we got a very... not angry, but very aggressive question.
Yes, about I saw this. Not, I sent it about, to Joe Weisenthal, actually.
Yeah. So on our Joe Weisenthal episode, he's, you know, the guy at Bloomberg, he was basically making this deficit spending case that Chris is making. Someone was very sort of aggressive towards us about how uncritically we took that statement. So I think the key thing to sort of like, because I think Chris, Sagar, and I all sort of agree here, the point isn't that we literally believe that you could spend money forever and there are no consequences. That's not the argument. The argument is that in a zero-sum politics and in a time when we have to make choices, when I go back to sort of the CARES Act debate with sort of the stimulus checks, I think it's much more important that we deal with the fact that there are literally tens, if not hundreds of millions of people who don't have jobs, don't have economic support. That seems to me to be the crisis. And I'm weighing that over having to deal with the fiscal picture 10 years sort of out. But Chris, like, what do you think about that part of the dynamic?
So let me try to use an analogy. So imagine, like, you're walking further out on an unsure surface, and at some point you're worried about it's going to collapse, right? What people are saying is, what deficit scolds are saying is, oh no, you can't go another step. It's going to collapse. Yes. You know, no, don't go out there. No, it's like you're watching your kid walk out on, like, you know, like a pile of sand. You just worry that the whole thing's going to collapse under the weight. You're like, don't go. Mm-hmm. All the evidence points, there's like somebody 100 yards out there jumping on a trampoline and it's not caving in. And yet we're still looking at ourselves saying, you know, don't go. You can probably go out 100 yards. After 100 yards, it's not clear how much further you can go. There is a point. They are correct. There is a point at which the whole thing collapses. So this is where I disagree with Joe to the degree we've had a conversation about it. This will get very geeky, if you don't mind me being geeky, because I used to have a PhD in mathematics and physics. And so I was a bond trader. But there's a point of non-linearity. There's a point at which we have all this credibility that we can, we have these chips we can spend. We don't know when it's going to end. Like, at some point it can all come crashing down, but we're pretty damn sure that point is nowhere close. So but there is a point. So the critics are right. There is a point at which this whole house of cards, you know, falls apart. So to use the analogy of House of Cards, we're like at fourth level, right? And you're just worried one more card is going to collapse. And then there's a guy over there who has a house 55 stories higher, mm-hmm. There is a point it's going to collapse, but we're not close to it yet. So it's right to be cautious. It's a right to be mindful at the time. This thing can turn on a dime, and our spending can boomerang. But there's a lot of warning signs of when that point is that we have to be aware of. And one of those is inflation.
That's an incredibly good way to put it. And it's actually much easier, I think, for people to understand. So whoever you are, angry debt voter or angry debt listener, that's your answer. I want to end kind of with this. We touched a little bit on it about non-voters. I'm kind of obsessed with this data. The Knight Foundation, I'm sure you've seen it, has that 100 million project, which kind of like surveys non-voters. Your book essentially was the photojournalistic or ethnography edition of that, which is to go out and speak to many of these non-voters. There's a big debate, Chris, which is that in such a low trust society, in a society where there's such little faith in any established institutions, what can actually be done to activate non-voters? Or is there goes to what Marshall was asking before. Is there too much cynicism out there? And are there actors who are empowered in our society with so much cynicism that they are going to prevail at this point and we're too far gone? What do you think?
Well, this gets back to what earlier conversation we had about populism. I mean, populists are activists. They're the people who can animate the non-voter. They're the people who can break through the noise and give somebody why I thought Trump would win last time is I used the drunk test. I said, the people I know, right? If you wake up hungover, do you vote? The people I met on the road who were Trump voters were going to they woke up hungover and they found their car had a flat tire. They're going to fucking walk to the place and vote. Hillary people, man, you had one beer and like you stubbed your toe, you weren't voting. So that the activation energy, how much does it take to get you to vote? Populists are great at activating people. The good populist is somebody who can activate them to vote. So I think that's the only point. I think the cynicism is so deep, and I actually will stick my head out. I think it's justified. I'm on the non-voter side. I'm their advocate at this point because I think they're rightfully just. The cynicism is so from their perspective, they have the right view, which right view is understandable view. It's fully understandable. It's an understandable view, and it takes a lot to change that. And I think there hasn't been anything recently that's given me much hope that. From their perspective, I'm trying to put myself in their mindset to give them hope that, there's a reason to get excited. So I'm actually if you're completely disconnected from politics and you get a check from $1,000 that says Trump on it, that's activation energy, man. That's why I'm still confused to that point. But I think you need kind of these simple, broad things that get people excited that to get them out of their cynicism. They give them some belief that actually something's going to change, man.
And this is just what, and I keep asking this because I'm really trying. I think I have empathy, but I'm just sort of struggling just because I sort of see the world through a political lens. So I can admit that's sort of the issue, but like a lot of those people are in sort of the Rust Belt, right? Like that's where these conversations, and that's a stereotype, but that's sort of, let's say we're talking about the people in those communities, right? Like Mitt Romney opposed the auto bailout. And that's basically something he walked back doing. So what's so hard for me is that I definitely agree that you need sort of positive things to activate people's energies. But the reason why I'm frustrated with the cynicism and why I don't think it's justified is that there are just all these empirical situations where we could just sort of see, oh, this side was in power, X thing happened. This other side was in power, Y thing happens. And it's so clear that these sort of things are happening. There are so many Iraq war with Bush, auto bailout with Obama, stimulus package with Obama, Medicaid expansion, Trump saying he wants to take it back. Those are clear examples for me of how the cynicism is just simply not justified. I think if it was actually true, because this is not true, that the center left and the center right would pursue the same exact policies, then that'd be justified. But it's just not true. And it's never been true.
I think it's a perspective issue of how disconnected people are from, like, you know, the, you know, when you, it's almost like, you know, when you're that down, when you're that far low, it doesn't really change your life that much. And, you know, but I think it's just also, you know, it's just the sense that in the broad scope of things, sure, you might have got, you know, under Obama, you might have gotten a slightly uptick, you know, but you're rising from the fifth level of the basement to the fourth and a half level from the basement, right? Yeah. So it just feels very much like, but when the problem is because of social media and because of TV and because of movies, you're not comparing yourself to the, you're looking at the very top. Yeah. And that gap is just so large that it, you know, sure. Okay. You know, you know, your life got incrementally better, but, you know, compared to, you know, Jeb, I'm sorry to pick on Jeb all the time. he has such a great name though. Compared to Jeb, I mean, it's like, no, you know, or compared to the person on the, who's Instagramming from their yacht, you know? So I think there's a perspective issue that makes it hard to like say, oh, well, thank you for the crumbs sort of attitude. You know, when they really want is kind of dramatic change that makes them feel like, you know, it's like I said, there's two ladders and they're on the wrong ladder and they know it. And so you've made the ladder a little less sinky, you know, you've given a little more stable foundation, which is nice, but they're still on the wrong ladder. Yeah. You know, it's not sinking as quickly. So I think there's a perspective issue that, but also, I'm not here to romanticize, you know, people at the same time. It's like, there's some people just make bad choices, you know?
So on that point though, cause we're getting to where my, deep existential angst at things I see on Twitter, that's what this real conversation is about. And I'm not bringing this example up to voter shame, but like, let's talk about Ken Bone for 1 second, because Ken Bone is someone who like very publicly has made a thing out of, I'm this undecided voter, you know, I don't know what to sort of choose. And, you know, recently he announced that he was deciding to vote for Jorgensen, the Libertarian candidate, because he didn't like Biden and Trump. And the number one issue he was voting on was like ending regime change wars. And from my perspective, that's like insane. Because if you're actually looking at Biden and Trump and you can empirically know one of the two of them are going to be president, like Joe Biden is the one who's bringing in people. And I think they were good faithful in this, but the people who supported the Libya intervention, who supported, the further Syrian intervention to a higher degree than we even got, who in many ways supported the Iraq war. Trump, like, I think the one thing that Trump has empirically done, and he's gotten, you know, awkwardly close of a couple North Korean and Iran situations, but he has emphatically not been a democracy promotion regime change war ender. So when Ken Bone says that, I see him as being someone who's engaging in this like bad faith, like fake, like aesthetic game. It's not actually about ideas and policy.
That's what all voting is though, right? Because mathematically your vote doesn't matter one iota. There's zero chance your vote's going to determine anything, right? And people kind of know that. And so Ken Bone is a perfect example of that. He's doing this for attention. And that's what voting is, largely a symbolic act. That's why I laugh when I see people like, you know, Chris Hayes, who I happen to like on Twitter, like I
waited. That's your hottest take, by the way.
Like I waited online for 2.5 hours to vote. Look at me. And it's like, you're just doing that for clout, man. Everybody knows who you voted for. And you're in New York City. And it doesn't matter one fucking bet who you voted for. Like, there is no election that's ever been decided by one vote at the national state level. Okay. Like, No, your vote doesn't matter. So it's a symbolic thing. So Ken Bone is a perfect example of who's getting clout out of A, his funny name, and B, you know, going through this agonizing thing. And so I think that's what we do when we vote. It's largely a symbolic act, you know, that and collectively can have an outcome, but you know, individually, no, you're part of a, you want to be on the right side of history. You want to be on the right side of your friends. You want to be on the right side of Twitter arguments, you know? So I think that's why you know, that's why I'll defend, basically, I'll be the mob lawyer for people who don't vote. like, you know, they like, because, you know, no, your vote doesn't matter, man. Like, so you might like, Why bother?
And yet, I just want to say, before we end, please go out and vote.
Yes.
Mark and I voted. Chris is voting as well. We're all getting it done this week. Because in the aggregate, it does matter. However, I completely understand why many people don't. And if you want to learn more about it, I recommend that you go and you read Chris's book, Dignity. It's just one, it's a fantastic work that looks at, you know, non-voters and many working class people just up and, you know, up with no filters, just exactly in their own words, which is probably the most valuable thing that we could have. And Chris, thank you for joining us. Your perspective is just so valuable.
Thank you guys, and vote, people.
Yes. Chris, tell people where they can find you on Twitter and your website.
My name is, I think I'm listed as my name, Chris Arnade, A-R-N-A-D-E, and I have no website.
Got it.
So,
he's got one of the best Twitter feeds in the game, and I highly recommend that you go out and follow him. Chris, thanks for joining us.
And thank you guys for having me again.
Yeah, of course, Chris.
Great talking to you, man. Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. As always, do us a favor and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Really helps other people find the show. If you want to ask us a question, you can leave us a written review or take a screenshot of that review and email it in to realignmentpod@gmail.com, and we'll answer your question live here on the air.
As always, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting, hosting, and sponsoring this podcast. Be sure to go to rebootconference.org to see all the great stuff we have for you on November 6th, 9th, and 10th. We'll see you guys on Thursday.